Alaska seems to specialize in attracting people with a sense of adventure, wildlife enthusiasts, and people who want to try their hand at something different, and visitors who don't just want to see Alaska through a window, but crave actual experiences. What should be on the top of your list in the Great Land? Lisa Maloney joins us now for insider advice on the top things to do and see in Alaska. Lisa's lived there for more than 30 years and authors the Moon Guidebooks to Alaska. She joins us from her home in Anchorage. Lisa, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
And what a cool gig you have, Alaska, writing guidebooks to Alaska. And that's a big territory with lots to see. And I would imagine in your work, you come across some pretty cool experiences that you'd want to share with people.
I do, although I have to say some of the best experiences have sort of happened by accident. You know, they're all wonderful, but the best ones are not always where I expect to find them.
Oh, what's a good example of that?
One of the best examples is one of my favorite ways to travel around Southeast Alaska is on the Alaska State Ferry. I jokingly call it the poor woman's alternative to a cruise ship, but it's also a great way to mingle with the locals while you're there and get a real insight to life, because you might be sharing the ferry with a basketball team that's commuting from a high school on one island to the other one.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So while I'm on the ferry, you can get a cabin or a stateroom. But my favorite thing to do is to take my sleeping bag and race everyone else up to the solarium, which is a covered but open air sun deck on the very top floor of the ship. And they have these plastic loungers where you can stretch out your sleeping bag and just camp there.
So you just stake that out and then you have it for the duration.
Exactly. You just got to get there soon enough to get a little corner of floor space.
Yeah.
And then it's the best night's sleep that I have ever had. You have sort of the thrum of the ferry's engines underneath you, and there's that really faint vibration and the fresh sea air coming at you.
Nice.
And one time while I was doing that, I happened to open my eyes and sit up and wake up the next morning, and the very first thing I saw was a humpback whale just flying through the air in a full breach and smashing back down into the water.
Don't you think it's amazing, or sort of like counterintuitive or whatever, that you, camping out on a public ferry, are probably having a richer experience than people spending a heck of a lot more money than you are, assuming you just want to experience Alaska?
I don't think it's counterintuitive at all, because I think the more money you spend, the more convenience and the more luxury you get.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to poo-poo those things at all. I enjoy a bit of convenience and luxury, too. But I think there's sometimes an inverse relationship between the amount of convenience. To a point, I will say there are certain big experiences like bear viewing, for example. There's not much of a way to get around a pretty big price tag on that one, but it's still a great bucket list item.
I'd like to just whip through, in your book, you list, you know, your favorite experiences. I'd like to just give you a minute or so for each of these experiences, just to let us know why you would include that on your top list of experiences. First of all, just wildlife viewing, bears, whales, moose, eagles, walruses. What should we be mindful of when it comes to just seeing wildlife in their element?
Two things right off. One of the standing jokes is that sometimes people who've come a long way to see the wildlife here are sad if maybe they didn't get to see as much as they were expecting to see, or if they didn't see the animals as promptly as they hoped. And sort of the standing joke is that someone might come up to a park ranger, for example, and say, "When do you send the bears out?"
Yeah.
So one big thing to keep in mind is that they really are wild, and they have a lot more space to roam up here than you would in another place. So the sightings are unpredictable, but they're all the more special because of that. You are seeing the closest thing that a human can ever get to the true wild animal.
You know, I've only had one week in Alaska, and it was one of the highlights of my whole traveling life was being in a kayak where a river was tumbling into the fjord, and a bear was just sitting there, and he would just paw salmon whenever he wanted, when he'd just paw it, and it would be there, and he'd climb back up to his little mound, and he'd munch it, and it was just like a little kid with a bag of popcorn. It was amazing to be so close to that. And I guess, if like you said, it'll cost money to see a lot of the salmon. It takes patience, but that's worth having on your list. We're getting insider tips on the things any visitor to Alaska should plan to do and see right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Our guide is Lisa Maloney. In the Moon Guidebook to Alaska, Lisa provides tips for independent travelers to view wildlife at Denali National Park, or for watching the teams take off from the sidelines of the Iditarod sled dog race. You'll find her notes for hitting the trails year-round in and near Anchorage at hikingalaska.net. Her books are 50 Hikes Around Anchorage and Day Hiking South Central Alaska. Lisa also provides visitor tips on packing light for Alaska and traveling the state on small planes. It's at cometoalaska.net. How about glacier viewing? If people want to see glaciers, of course, that's a big part of an Alaska experience.
Sure. So for glacier viewing, the most important thing is to go to the right part of the state. Southeast Alaska has lots of options if you want to see tidewater glaciers, so glaciers that actually come down to meet the sea. So does South Central Alaska. And in South Central, there are actually a couple of glaciers that you can drive within walking or viewing distance of. So making sure you go to the right place is a big deal. When you actually see a glacier in person, it is stunning how big they are. It's also surprising that you can't get right up against them because every so often pieces of the glacier break off, which is spectacular and exciting. But it's also very dangerous if you're too close, whether on land or on water, because they can crush you, for example.
So take seriously your local guide's advice. If you're on a boat or something like that, you could find yourself in a disaster if you're there just when you get what you came to see was a big chunk falling off.
And that is a big thing about Alaska. Because it is such a wild and uncontrolled environment, which is part of its allure, you never quite know what's going to happen. So you have to apply a liberal helping of common sense.
Wow, you never know what's going to happen. And there must be a knack for that because you've got to be in the right spot at the right time when it does happen. You know, there's a lot of people go all the way to Alaska and they've got this bucket list, but they go home maybe disappointed because maybe they didn't have the patience or they didn't have the information to find themselves in the right place at the right time. Coming to mind when I talk about that is the Northern Lights. You have to be there in the off season to see the Northern Lights, don't you?
You do. Or if you're very, very lucky, you might come in the shoulder season and you might be able to enjoy some of the summer attractions. And maybe, I'm emphasizing maybe and might because those really apply here, you might get to see a bit of the Northern Lights. But really, if you want good odds of doing either thing, you need to choose one or the other, summer attractions or Northern Lights. It's a great excuse to come here twice.
Now, that's called the Aurora Borealis also?
It is, as opposed to the Aurora Australis. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but that would be the Southern Hemisphere's version of the same thing.
So it's not just like either you see it or you don't. There's shoulder season, small versions of it, and then it builds up. But if you want that orgasmic Aurora Borealis, you probably want to be there in the dead of winter.
It would be a good idea. And the main reason for that, so the aurora shines year-round. It doesn't care that it's summer. It doesn't say, it's summer, I'm going to hibernate in the inverse of what a bear does. The thing is that the sky tends to be so light that you cannot see it during the summer, even while it's shining.
Right. So it's just a matter of dark sky.
Exactly. Dark sky for long enough. And during the deeps of winter and even the early spring, we have dark sky for most of the day in addition to the night. And that just really increases your chances of being able to see the aurora.
Tell me, you've been there for 30 years as a guide and a writer. You must have seen it many times in many places. Where's the very best Aurora Borealis you've seen? Where was it and why was it so good? What was it like?
There are two bests. The best that would be easiest for somebody to duplicate when they're visiting would be up in Fairbanks, Alaska. That is the number one destination that I recommend people to go to see the aurora. It's not that you can't see it anywhere else, but the odds are just much better up there. And I was at a fairly remote little place called Chena Hot Springs Resort, and they stuck us in a snowcat, a little treaded vehicle, and they trundled us up to the top of a hill, and you get out and you look up, and it's just like the sky is spangled with different colors, and you'll see coronas sometimes. It's like almost like the eye of Sauron, except it's very beautiful. It's not scary. It's this expanding hole in the sky that is lined with purple and red and green. And even living up here, you do not always get to see those colors. And more importantly, you do not always get to see them with the naked eye. A lot of the time, the aurora that you see with your naked eye is much more diffuse than what your camera, even on your smartphone, can pick up because it's gathering more light.
Mm. People must have been wonderstruck together at that moment.
You know, we all were. It is really a great equalizer. It doesn't matter how long you've lived up here, how long, you know, you could be here for one day or you could be on a 3-month odyssey all over the state. But there is just nothing like seeing the sky come alive.
So, Lisa, I just hate to break the dramatic mood about the Aurora Borealis, but 90%, well, most people are going to be there in the summer when there is zero chance of seeing the Aurora Borealis. But this is my advice in Iceland, is to remind people in the summer there are planetariums and little science exhibits in the cities where you can just pay to see an Aurora Borealis show in the land of the Aurora Borealis in the middle of the summer. Is there anything like that in Alaska?
Absolutely. You will find something resembling that in most visitor centers around the state. But one of the long-standing productions is actually here in Anchorage. And it's in our downtown performing arts center, so the same place that we would go to see a traveling Broadway show, for example.
It's important to remember you could go in the winter just to see it and come up with zero. But if you go in the summer, you can see it in a contained way without any risk and for a lot less money. So it's just a little practicality considered there. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We are talking with Lisa Maloney, and she writes the Moon Guidebook to Alaska. She also writes a book called Day Hiking in South Central Alaska. And Lisa's joining us now to share some of the best experiences in Alaska. Also, I want to talk about the Iditarod, because that must be the biggest event in Alaska. It's certainly an experience, and it's not in the peak season. It's in March, right?
That's right. It is definitely one of the most famous events, and it has a whole sector of tourism around it. It's a, we'll call it a micro sector, because again, the infrastructure in all of these communities is not necessarily there to support a huge crowd of people at once. But you'll have people who actually pay to fly out in a small plane to some of the stops along the Iditarod, or they might volunteer there, which is a great way to...
They could go to McGrath. That's a major checkpoint halfway on the basic trail, and the radio station in McGrath actually runs our show, so
they
may be listening right now. Yeah. But for most people, the Iditarod is a ceremonial start in Anchorage, and then what, the next day or two, the actual start, which is not so public.
Right. So there are three sort of key intersections where people can access the Iditarod. The first is the ceremonial start in Anchorage, which is a wonderful carnival atmosphere.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!
I know that every year I like to pull out just my folding camp chair and a thermos of hot cocoa. And I have a favorite place to go downtown and watch, because if you look at the map of the Iditarod, the track takes a big sweeping right turn. And it's really exciting to watch teams go around that. And sometimes they wipe out.
You know, my sister, Jan Steves, actually ran the Iditarod and finished it. And one of the big joys for her was choosing who would be in the sled with her at the ceremonial start, because I guess the best supporters or friends or loved ones of the racers get to pile onto the sled with them on that ceremonial start. But then it gets down to serious business later.
I think nowadays you can also pay to do that. It's called the IDITA Rider, R-I-D-E-R program.
Oh, is that right? Okay, well, they got to fund it somehow. But it was a big joy for her a few years ago.
There are now over 700 dogs that have passed
And Lisa, we got a couple more minutes, just very quickly. Is there much gold rush history? Where would you go for to see gold rush history?
So you will find gold rush history in almost any sizable community in Alaska. So Fairbanks, yes. Skagway is not a big community, but it is a huge destination for the gold rush.
Yeah.
Anchorage, not so much. There is some, but it's buried beneath a whole lot of other interesting stuff.
Uh-huh.
And then all up and down southeast, there's usually some kind of a gold rush story in there somewhere. But if I had to pick three communities now that I'm thinking it through, I'd say Fairbanks, Skagway, and Juneau are the big ones where it's easy to access. And then to a lesser degree, it's a little harder to access, but Nome is surprisingly quite a place to visit for gold rush history as well.
I wouldn't have thought that. I'm just about out of time here, and on my notes, I had Denali National Park would be a great experience. It seems like a wonderfully run national park, and it's just a what is it? How accessible is Denali? How would you get to Denali?
So you can get to the entrance of Denali National Park via train or via car, and there are a couple of shuttles that go back and forth between Anchorage and Fairbanks, which are on opposite ends of the road that accesses Denali.
Okay, so it is accessible from either of the big cities. And Lisa, what I really want to be sure to get to is the opportunity, when in Alaska, to have a Alaskan Native cultural experience. Tell us just what are the opportunities there, and what is the fine sort of thinking between respectful cultural tourism and not respectful tourism when it comes to Alaska Native heritage?
Sure. So there is a Native cultural center in almost every major community around Alaska. The best one in the state for my money, and I am a little biased because I live in Anchorage, but here in Anchorage, we have a center called the Alaska Native Heritage Center. And the reason I feel like it's the best is because it discusses and exemplifies the vibrant Native cultures from all around the state, okay, whereas the regional centers will sometimes focus on just the culture in that region. One of the biggest surprises for people when they come here is that they might expect Indigenous culture to be very homogenous because they think of Alaska as one state, but it is a collection of many different climates and terrain types that require different technology and different knowledge to not just survive, but thrive. And I think focusing on the fact that Alaska Native culture is still very much present and it's alive. So we're not talking about people of the past. We're talking about people that are here right now who want to share their culture with you. Maintaining an open attitude of curiosity and an eagerness to learn. So I think if you sort of focus on those things, you're guiding yourself straight to being a respectful guest.
And it's great that you can have what you consider the best educational experience, perhaps in the most accessible place in Anchorage, for kind of a virtual tour of the entire Native Alaskan world. Lisa, talking with you, I understand why you're so highly thought of with my friends at Moon Publications. You write this guidebook on Alaska, and clearly you know what you're doing. And I've been working very hard on our guidebooks, updating it, and I know I always come home with some sort of particular joy in my last research stint. When you updated your Alaska book last, if you think back on it, what was the biggest good news you brought home?
So the biggest good news for me was absolutely how many businesses had survived the coronavirus pandemic and were actually expanding in some cases. Another thing that was very exciting that ties right into it was also how many new businesses have been springing up lately. I don't know what happened, but it's like a font of creativity and participation has just opened right up, and it's wonderful.
I just love what I call a corona bonus, when anybody can bring home some news like that after those very difficult couple of years. Well, Lisa Maloney, thank you for your work. Thank you for joining us, and best wishes as you help all of us travelers better appreciate the land that you call home, Alaska.
Thank you, Rick. I hope anyone who comes here has a wonderful time.
Alaska's flag to Alaskans dear, the simple flag of our last frontier.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, with Kazmara Hall and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Find out more about our guests and listen to a podcast version of the show whenever you like at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll look for you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.